Quran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran imposes sanctions on several Canadian individuals and an entity for supporting anti-Iran terrorist groups and inciting violence. North Korea fires more ballistic missiles in response to South's drills with the US amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. And the Russian president says Moscow may quit Ukraine grain delivery deal again if Kiev violates security guarantees it has given to Moscow. Welcome to World News live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story, Iran says it has imposed sanctions on a number of Canadian individuals and an entity over their support for terrorist groups and inciting violence against Iranians. The foreign ministry said that the sanctioned individuals and entity have supported the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group and spread false information about the country. It said they also played a key role in imposing a brutal sanctions regime on the Iranian people. The sanctions list includes Canada's National Defense Minister, the Chief Justice, the Chief of the Defense Staff, and the commanders of the Canadian Air Force and Navy. The National Post newspaper has also been blacklisted because of its anti-Iran positions. A ban on issuing visas and entry into Iran, as well as seizure of their properties within the Islamic Republic's territory, are among the punishments considered for the sanctioned individuals and entity. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the 1979 takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran proved that Washington is completely vulnerable. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei added that the rise to power of the current and previous U.S. presidents is a sign of America's decline. He added that U.S. miscalculations during its invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq also exposed its vulnerability. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the history of confrontation between Iran and the U.S. dates back to the CIA-orchestrated coup in Iran in 1953. But now, he said, American politicians are hypocritically and shamelessly claiming they are supporters of the Iranian people. Iran's leader also referred to the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, saying the Iranian nation would never forget the killing of their anti-terror icon and would take action in a suitable time. Ayatollah Khamenei also pointed to the recent riots in the country and called them a, quote, hybrid war. He said a recent intelligence report showed how the enemies had been planning to instigate chaos across different Iranian cities using all means. He noted that the Iranian nation, however, made those plots futile through vigilance. Journalist and political commentator from London, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, tells us why Iran's leader has pointed to the 1953 coup in Iran in his latest remarks.
So when Ayatollah Khamenei talks about that particular coup, not only is it a reminder for the Islamic Republic of Iran's own citizens, but actually those who mistakenly perhaps still believe that the American dream is the Iranian dream, perhaps need to review some of their own history and to look at what were the results of that 1953 coup. First of all, 26 years of authoritarian dictatorial rule was one outlet. The other was that all of the Iranian oil industry fell into the hands of the British and Americans. Essentially, they plundered Iranian oil wealth for those decades. You saw a huge reduction of people's freedoms and other liberties. People's economic welfare was very much suppressed as well at that time. And what did the Americans get out of it? Well, they say they got the Soviet Union to not get into Iran and the oil, et cetera, as I pointed out. But in reality, it's important for people to remember their history, because those who forget their past cannot possibly make sense of their present.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan traveled to Iran this week on an official visit aimed at expanding bilateral ties. Speaking at a joint presser, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi said peace and stability in the Caucasus is of great significance to the Islamic Republic, and that any foreign interference in the affairs of the rest of the region will only complicate the situation.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has held high-level talks in Tehran following a trilateral meeting with Russian and Azerbaijani leaders on the conflict in the Caucasus region. He was officially received by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi on Tuesday morning, and the two held talks at the Sarabot Palace in the capital, Tehran. In addition to a bilateral meeting, the two top executive officials held a meeting of high-level delegations, and after attending the signing ceremony of a cooperation document in the field of energy, they elaborated on the results of their consultations in a joint press conference. The Iranian president stated that Pashinyan's visit to Iran will be a turning point in the development of ties between the two neighboring countries.
Neighborhood policy is one of the policies emphasized by the government, and during this administration we had several meetings with Mr. Pashinyan. In these meetings, especially in this particular meeting, the focus of the negotiations was the development of commercial, economic and security relations between the two countries.
Expressing satisfaction with the growing trends of relations between the two countries, Raisi pointed to the diverse and numerous capacities available in Iran and Armenia, calling for an all-out effort to improve the level of relations and expand bilateral cooperation. The Iranian president pointed to energy cooperation as one of the capacities available to improve the level of relations between the two countries, saying, "The Islamic Republic is ready to expand cooperation in other economic and commercial areas, including in increasing the export of technical and engineering services." Also noting that the Caucasus region is a part of Iran's history, civilization, and culture, Raisi underscored that security and peace in the Caucasus region are very important for Iran. The Iranian president added that negotiations with Pashinyan led to the conclusion that resolving the issues of the region must occur at the hands of officials and authorities of the region, and any interference by foreigners will only create problems rather than solve them. Pashinyan, for his part, appreciated the constructive role of the Islamic Republic in the region and stressed that Iran's efforts have always been aimed at stabilizing and strengthening peace and security in the region. Pashinyan expressed gratitude for the priority given by Raisi's administration to the development of ties with the neighboring countries. The Armenian premier also called for strengthening transit cooperation between the two countries to connect the Black Sea to the Persian Gulf.
Pashinyan's visit to Tehran comes on the heels of a trip by the Iranian foreign minister to Armenia. During the October visit, Amir Abdullahian opened an Iranian consulate general in Armenia's southernmost city of Kapan, near the Iranian border. The latest diplomatic efforts by Tehran are aimed at securing the country's national interests.
Iran opened a consulate in the southern Armenian city of Kapan on October 21st, nearly a year after expressing interest in doing so. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian officially inaugurated the consulate. At the opening ceremony, Amir Abdullahian stated that the security of Armenia and the region is Iran's security. He called for the development of north-south transportation corridor through Armenia. He also said Tehran's policies to respect territorial integrity as well as internationally recognized borders. Tehran had previously stated that changes in its borders and transit links with Armenia would be a red line that it would not tolerate being crossed. That's when Turkey and Azerbaijan have been planning to establish a new transport link called the Zangzur Corridor. In case of opening, it will affect Iran-Armenia commerce and could sever a major Iranian transit link with the South Caucasus. Meanwhile, Tehran has not contented itself with only diplomatic messages. The inauguration of the Kapan consulate came after several days of large-scale military exercises by IRGC near Iran's borders with Azerbaijan. The latest simultaneous diplomatic and defensive moves clearly show the Iranian government is ready to defend its national interests in all seriousness.
The Israeli military keeps up its deadly violence against Palestinians, with the regime forces killing yet another person in the occupied West Bank. Israeli soldiers shot dead the 42-year-old man named Mahmoud Rayan during an overnight raid. The confrontation took place in a village named Beit Daru in northwestern Al-Quds. Israel has recently tightened its deadly grip on the occupied West Bank and widened its crackdown on Palestinians there. Over 120 Palestinians have lost their lives in the West Bank this year alone. North Korea has once again fired multiple ballistic missiles in another show of force amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. According to South Korea's military, the North fired three ballistic missiles towards the east. They included a long-range missile fired from the capital Pyongyang and two short-range missiles from north of Pyongyang. One of the missiles triggered an alert to residents in parts of central and northern Japan to seek shelter. The launches came a day after the North fired more than 20 missiles, and that's the most in a single day. One of those missiles landed off South Korea's coast for the first time. The launches came after Pyongyang demanded the U.S. and the South stop joint military exercises, saying such provocations can no longer be tolerated. Washington and Seoul say Pyongyang is about to resume testing of nuclear bombs for the first time since 2017, and that's why they are holding the drills. Pyongyang, however, views the drills as a rehearsal for an invasion.
The U.S. and South Korea Monday began their largest joint Air Force exercises ever, with 240 planes participating. North Korea warned the U.S. about the drills, which it views as a rehearsal for invasion. Pyongyang Wednesday launched more than 20 ballistic missiles, with one missile landing south of the maritime border, says South Korea's military.
Since 8:51 a.m. today, North Korea launched three ballistic missiles and one of them landed in the East Sea, south of the NLL. Today's launch is the first time a North Korean missile landed near our territorial waters, south of the NLL, and this is unprecedented and unacceptable. Our military will respond sternly to this act.
South Korea then launched three guided missiles from jet fighter aircraft toward the northern side of the Eastern Sea border. Japan also reacted to North Korea's missile firing.
North Korea has been repeatedly firing missiles at an unprecedented pace, and it's absolutely impermissible. Given the heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula, I would like to convene a National Security Council as soon as possible.
The security atmosphere surrounding the Korean Peninsula has been steadily deteriorating since conservative South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol came to power in May, promising to strengthen the alliance with the U.S. and take a hard line with North Korea. In late summer, U.S. and South Korea held the largest land-based military exercises since 2017. During a previous South Korean missile launch in response to North Korean missile testing, one South Korean missile was lost. Another landed 700 meters from a residential area, causing a fire. This demonstrates the inherent risk of this missile testing and joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises that could lead to an accident or miscalculation and potentially armed conflict. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Turning elsewhere now, Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that Moscow may leave the Ukraine grain deal again if Kiev violates its security guarantees.
Russia retains the right to leave these agreements if these guarantees from Ukraine are violated.
Putin said if Russia withdrew from the deal, it would continue to supply the entire grain delivered from Ukraine to the poorest countries free of charge. Putin's warning came after Russia resumed its participation in the UN brokered Ukraine grain delivery deal earlier on Wednesday. Moscow said it had received written security guarantees from Kiev to demilitarize the maritime corridor. Russia suspended the implementation of the deal on Saturday over a drone attack on its Black Sea fleet in Crimea. Russia blamed Ukraine for the attack, but Kiev dismissed Moscow's claim as a false pretext for suspending the deal. The British government has been criticized over its inhumane handling of an increasing number of migrants arriving on its shores. Nearly 1,000 desperate refugees and asylum seekers crossed the English Channel this past weekend alone, bringing the total number of people who have made the journey this year to nearly 40,000.
This is one of the UK's biggest migrant processing centres, a former military facility in Manston, southeast England. It's meant to house a maximum of 1,600 people for a day or two at a time. At the moment, it's holding four times its capacity. Many have been here for weeks. Some are having to sleep on cardboard or concrete floors.
The Independent Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration has described the conditions here as pretty wretched. There have also been calls for the government to get a grip and provide better provisions. Those calls have led to some migrants having been relocated, but thousands more stay on.
Hundreds more were moved here on the weekend after a man threw petrol bombs at a migrant center a short drive from here in Dover, injuring two people before killing himself. Those working with asylum seekers say the system needs a complete overhaul. A day after the Dover bomb attack, Interior Minister Suella Braverman, a darling of the Conservatives' right-wing faction, accused of blocking plans to tackle overcrowding at the Manston Center, called the increase in migrant arrivals an invasion. The British government says about 1,500 migrants crossed the English Channel in small boats over the weekend, and the total number so far this year is around 40,000. While the UK's Interior Minister fights for her job, from which she has already resigned once over a breach of security, pressure on her to put the country's immigration house in order is only growing. Saeed Burza, Kent, Southeast England.
Moving on, a report reveals that Saudis living in the US are being targeted as part of the kingdom's crackdown on dissidents living abroad. Prince Abdullah bin Faisal Al Saud, a graduate student at a Boston university, is the latest reported target. Court documents show he was imprisoned on a trip back to Saudi Arabia for making calls to his relatives inquiring about the detention of a fellow prince. Abdullah was sentenced to 30 years in jail in August. Destabilizing the kingdom and supporting dissidents were among the charges leveled against him. According to the FBI and rights groups, the kingdom has intensified its surveillance and intimidation of Saudis on U.S. soil. Crackdown on critics has stepped up under the de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman, who is also accused of ordering the brutal killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Birthday of Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam and heartiest congratulations to all our dear listeners on a day of rejoicing. Today, the 8th of Rabiul Thani, is the birthday of Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, And on this auspicious occasion, we present you a feature on the life and times of the 11th infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Please stay with us. Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, was born in Medina in the year 232 AH, corresponding to 845 AD, and was martyred at the young age of 28 years in Samarra in Iraq, where he and his father, Imam Hadi, peace upon him, were forcibly brought so that the tyrannical Abbasid regime could keep a watchful eye on the Prophet's righteous successors and the activities of their followers. His period of imamat, or divinely decreed leadership of mankind, was 6 years, during which he strove to enlighten the ummah with the genuine precepts of Islam, despite the bouts of imprisonment and house arrest that he was subjected to. His mother was the pious Lady Salil, who was also called Susan and Hadithe. His wife was the spotlessly pious lady Hazrat Narjis, peace upon her, the granddaughter of the Byzantine emperor, while on her mother's side she was descended from Simon, the disciple and testamentary legatee of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him. Lady Narjis, peace upon her, was to give birth to a radiant boy, who, as the son and successor of the 11th Imam, had to go into hiding or occultation by the will of God because of the persecution of the enemies, and will reappear in the end times as Qa'imul Mahdi to cleanse the earth of all vestiges of oppression and corruption, and to establish the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, like his forebears, was the picture of moral excellence and perfection. He was peerless in knowledge, forbearance, forgiveness, generosity, sacrifice, and piety. Whenever the Caliph Mu'tamid asked anybody about his captive, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, he was told that he fasted during the day and worship during the night, and that his tongue uttered no word but remembrance of the Almighty Creator. During the brief periods of freedom and a stay at home, people approached him to avail from his benevolence, and they went back well rewarded. Once, when the Abbasid Caliph asked Ahmad ibn Ubaidullah ibn Khaqan, his minister for Awqaf, or endowments, about the descendants of Imam Ali, peace upon him, he reported, "I do not know anybody among them who is more distinguished than Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him. None can surpass him in dignity, knowledge, piety, and abstinence, nor can anybody match him in the point of nobleness, majestic grandeur, modesty, and honesty." Once, when the Caliph Mu'taz, during a march past of the seemingly powerful Abbasid army, that was a terror from Europe and Africa to the borders of China and India, tried to ridicule the 11th Imam by asking him, "Where is your army?" The Imam gently raised his hand and asked the Caliph to have a look through two of his parted fingers. What the haughty Mu'taz saw in bewilderment and awe and with a quaking heart was an assembly of angels stretching all the way towards the sky and ready to annihilate the Abbasid forces if commanded. This explains the epithet Al-Askari, Arabic for military forces, that the 11th heir of Prophet came to acquire. Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, strove to steer societies to the shores of salvation by enlightening them with the purpose of creation, the duty towards God, obligation to God's Prophet, cognizance of the Prophet's divinely designated successors, and respect for the rights of mankind, in order to pave the way for the ideal society that his son and successor will accomplish. May God hasten the reappearance of the 12th Imam, an establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. In order to help Muslims stay firm on the path of God during the long period of occultation of his son and successor, the promised Mahdi, peace upon him, the 11th Imam expressed the following gem of a statement. It is obligatory for the people to follow the jurist who refrains from committing wrong, emphasizes his faith, opposes carnal desires, and obeys Allah's command. Here we present you excerpts of the 11th Imam's wonderful epistle to an Iranian Muslim, Ishaq ibn Ismail Nishaburi of Khorasan. You should know fully well, Ishaq, that whoever quits this world with blindness to facts and realities will be also blind in the world to come and in terrible error. O Ishaq, it is not the sights that are affected with blindness. In fact, it is the hearts that are in the chest. This is confirmed by God's citing of the saying of the wicked in his book of wisdom, Surah Taha, ayahs 124 and 125. And on the day of resurrection, we shall raise him blind. He will say, "My Lord, why have you raised me blind, though I used to see?" God will say, "So it is. Our signs came to you, but you forgot them, and thus you are forgotten on this day." In conclusion of our special feature, here are some wise sayings from the 11th Imam, which is indeed worth pondering upon. Generosity has a limit. When crossed, becomes extravagance. Caution has a limit. When crossed, becomes cowardice. Thriftiness has a limit. When crossed, becomes miserliness. Courage has a limit. When crossed, becomes foolhardiness. Let this moral lesson suffice. Refrain from doing anything which you would disapprove of it if done by someone else. Reasonless laughter is a sign of ignorance. The worst servants of God are those who are two-faced and two-tongued. They praise their present friends and backbite the absent. They envy them for obtaining graces and disappoint them when they suffer a misfortune. The most pious of people is he who stops at suspicious matters. The best worshipper is he who performs the obligatory religious affairs duly. The most abstinent of people is he who refrains from the unlawful. The most hardworking of people is he who keeps away from sins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestinian women. Israel has been imposing a siege on the Strip for more than 7 years, in addition to blocking the crossings and preventing people from traveling. Palestinian women played a significant role in highlighting these issues in media.
This indicates that the Palestinian society is developed and knows the importance of media. It was introduced to it in a miserable condition, as Israel is imposing a blockade and encroaching the Palestinians. Therefore, there must be a Palestinian reaction to document this situation. So, the Palestinians' media was the first to play the role in this field by graduating a Palestinian generation that is aware of what happens.
Practically, the beginning of journalism and production companies in the Gaza Strip witnessed a difficulty in women engagement. I can say that I lived two eras. The first was at the age of 16, which was too early and media was not developed. After that, people got used to intensive presence of media, women working there, and partnership between both genders. Why did it become normal? It was because the society realized that media is the base in the life of a society like Palestinians. We are the owners of a cause. This cause is only expressed to the whole world through media.
We started with the number of 100, then 200 after a few years. The number was constant for 4 to 5 years until 3 years ago. There were 650 students. Now there are 1,100 students enrolled in the Faculty of Journalism. The female students were forming 50% of the total number in the past years. However, it became 60 to 62%. And the rest are male students.
We receive applications of joining the journalists syndicate every day, especially of female journalism graduates. Female members of the syndicate are nearly 30% in whole Palestine and 25% in Gaza. This number is a good one for them as females.
Arab women in general suffer, in an Eastern society, from some traditions and beliefs that prevent them from working in certain careers. One of these careers is media and journalism. However, Palestinian women, in particular, were distinguished with making some breakthroughs. They achieved tangible success in careers related to radio and television in general, either as camera women, video editors, producers, directors, or anchors.
We as journalists are capable of delivering our message to the world through the culture and the mind energy we have. This happens through what happens around us and what we live. The University of Palestine has more than one major of media. There are public relations, interpretation, electronic journalism, and radio and television. This way, students have the opinion to choose one of these majors with what suits their environment and interests.
When I first studied media, I knew that I would have to go out many times, and there are some surprising things that may happen. Especially that here, in the Gaza Strip, there may suddenly happen bombing or breaking into the strip or something like that. I know that my work requires that I be ready any time.
No doubt the female journalist students in the Gaza Strip could get the respect and admiration of the society and its support in different ways. This includes families and other parts of society. For female journalists, their career is respected among society and is not similar to any other career.
This is a full-time job that requires time and effort. I use my time here to produce some dramas that embody the reality we live and some social series. These series may be comedies or patriotic.
Indicators of the situation in Gaza Strip are frightening. Unprecedented levels of poverty, unemployment, and dependence on aid have put so much pressure on Gazans.
I started my work about 8 years ago as a TV correspondent. As soon as I started, there has been a lot of difficulties, mainly the political situation. Working as a journalist in general, or a correspondent in particular, has its own difficulties. I'm a mother of four, and of course, coming to work, you always face the difficulties of coming to work, the threats everybody else here is facing, plus having to leave my children home alone. Well, it takes a lot of effort. I mean, I have to work extra hours sometimes, and my kids have to give in on a lot of things. I mean, I don't cook all the time, that's one thing, but they have gotten used to the lifestyle. Plus, our work is difficult when it's, you know, the season is hot, when there are war. Other times I have, you know, some easier times, but so it's give and take.
It's hard for a woman to work in this field, especially in a country that lives many proceedings and a conservative society. The beginning was hard, but at the end I proved myself and succeeded. I have proven that what I'm doing is a patriotic duty. Practically, if I manage work and home together, I can be successful in both. However, managing both comes at the expense of losing my comfort and psychological relief and even sleep hours.
ترحل شخصية
Photography is maybe one of the most difficult media arts. That's because a woman is carrying her camera and taking photos like what other male journalists do. She exerts efforts and tries to be the number one. Thus, the way society looks at this was harsh at the beginning. They didn't accept that. But we overcame that now, and they started facilitating the female journalist's mission and providing support. Some people knew my name and missed me, especially during the clashes of East Jabalia, as I was the only female shooting there. They're contacting me on Facebook and asking me where my visit is. They also offer help in case I can't go there. At the beginning of my career, the first challenge was my father, brothers, and my husband inquiring about what I'm doing. I was able to prove myself and make them change their attitude. The pressure was big that I was a mother and studying and working the same time. I had to manage these things without losing any of the three sides.
I was living in hard circumstances lately because I was doing my master's. That made me leave home for long hours, sometimes 12 hours. For sure, that affected me psychologically and physically. It also influenced my family, including my daughter and husband and my social life.
Luckily enough, I haven't faced any difficulties as a woman. I mean, Palestinians are used to women being always part of the life, the struggle. They have always been there, whether as political participants or working in all different fields. So I haven't faced any difficulties. I mean, the Palestinian society accepts the woman as part of it, so they even support us.
Nowadays, there is great development of the society's attitude to a female journalist. It became the opposite, as they would help and excuse her when she's late for home. Of course, there are exceptions. However, essentially, a successful female journalist takes care of herself and takes the society's traditions into consideration. This way, she will be respected, as I experienced.
One of the tiring things is that I'm pregnant and about to deliver a baby. It's possible to have the delivery symptoms any moment, but I'm still working. Despite everything, I'm happy that I'm working in my field and serving my nation and society. It's a national duty I should do.
To be a journalist in Gaza, working under aggressions, pressure, bad situation, financial cases of a humanitarian crisis, gives you courage and a big power and strong points, beliefs, methods to do and achieve more and more and more. And this is very important for my job right now, to prove that you are strong to be here in this position.
My first experience in war covering was disastrous and sad because it was hard to see casualties and martyrs of your nation. However, it was a big challenge for me that I could prove myself in the field. Other journalists were helpful as I was moving with them in their vehicles. We used to move together whenever there was bombing or shelling to the location. I challenged myself to hold back my tears in front of the martyrs' families and the fragments of children's bodies. Similar things happened during the funeral of Al-Darju children. I fainted after trying to touch their dead bodies. As a mother, I was strongly affected, and then I got over it.
We experience exceptional circumstances in Gaza. Anytime Israeli forces may break into the strip or bomb it, we may have clashes with the army. So I need to be ready and present anytime, ready to leave home to work to cover the news. This requires effort and time of what I save for my family.
I have just graduated from university and I started working before that. I was working at more than one place. I was an announcer in addition to other things. Besides that, I was a student and had a life. Society is divided into categories according to people's attitude to a working woman in general, and a female journalist in particular. For example, some people are open-minded and respect female journalists because their job is tiring. They have enough of work, pressure, are in front of the camera and under different kinds of pressure. Some other people have another viewpoint. A woman cannot appear on TV as an announcer in an Eastern conservative Arab society. She cannot get dressed in certain ways and cannot be on TV from the first place.
The Women's Affairs Center in the Gaza Strip is concerned with media. It has a unit for television production and documentary movies. Many young Palestinian women start their careers from this place. The center organizes media courses regularly to improve the skills of the trainees so that they become able to work in this field.
The Women's Affairs Center has started training since 1995. We started our own activities by a Canadian producer who trained a group of 15 girls. It was a year and a half of training on documentary production. However, we first renovated the center, implemented for the strategic planning. Then we started a 200-hour training course for some young women who wanted to learn production, shooting, and editing. Our first experience included 12 young women. Then the next year, the number increased to be 20. A year after, the applications were about 100. And we started holding entrance exams and other exams for the candidates. We would also select the best trainees and the ones we feel they would carry on in this field.
I chose to join the Women's Affairs Center by a recommendation of a friend. I was recommended to join it to grow the talent I already have, which is production and television. I went there and registered for training courses for a year and a half. Then, at the end of this year, a movie was produced, or it was a documentary that was done as a production experience.
Here is a group of young women who are being trained in many kinds of television skills, like voice, filming, lighting, and production.
We asked the center to hold these courses because we needed a staff for dramas in the movie. We wanted to know how to create drama in the movie, so it was not a regular shooting. It had to be professional.
I'm the camerawoman of drama and documentary films. I was the camerawoman of Notice and The Ways, two drama films. I'm also one of the editors of the film Where Are My Stuff?
From the first places, I grew up in a sports house and was brought up doing sports. My family was and is still supporting me. They are the ones who encouraged me in this field. This has made me more courageous and honest. My father, may Allah grant him health, is the one who advises me and discusses everything with me. My father and I are close friends, and I consult him about everything. He tells me what to do without being persistent.
Actually, my family is very proud of me. I worked on the movie Hope Remains a Title and won first place, and that was the first movie I won first place for in the Cinema and Art Production Festival. Since then, everyone started supporting me and telling me what to do. They gave me the choice to go anywhere.
There's a story for my journey. Leaving home to office means traveling from east the strip to the west. This path was a minefield for me. As soon as I reached my office, I went on air and reported news happening on my way there. There were cars bombed on my way and citizens killed. One time, Israel hit a market on the same road, Omar al-Mukhtar Street. So the way itself was a story for me.
Leaving home and reaching office was martyrdom. Reaching office meant I had a new life. During the war, we didn't know the source of the shelling. There was shelling by tanks, planes, and boats. That was a really wild war, as the only people moving in streets were either fighters or journalists. Press men were bombed either by targeting their vehicles or their offices. We were targeted in Al Alam Channel or Media Group Company with a rocket during work. They didn't consider the existence of journalists in the place, though there were press signs like TV press. The targets were journalists who represent media, and they wanted to silence us. Personally speaking, that war was a media war. Massacres and the killing of the innocent was broadcasted live. I think that holding trials for Israeli leaders or issuing arresting warrants for them by some European courts was motivated by media records. There were warrants of arrest or deprivation of entering some countries. These courts depended on the testimony of journalists. Thus, Israel realized how dangerous a Palestinian journalist could be and what are they capable of to highlight the Palestinian cause and suffering. And also to show that war aims at killing the innocent and not ending the resistance, or terrorism, as they call it. The main goal was killing Palestinians. The bombing was random and shallow. They executed massacres, used white phosphorus, and burned people. No everyone was targeted in the strip, either directly or indirectly.
The Palestinian media is a part of the national Palestinian resistance. So everyone is engaged in those clashes. In every Palestinian confrontation during the past 50 years, journalists were in the front with people sacrificing their lives. They were a target of Israeli assassinations. Therefore, this is a historical evidence for the Palestinian media. Even during the last Israeli aggression on the Strip, a number of journalists were targeted and murdered.
I would say something my family may not like. I was destined to have a new life twice after the first and second wars on Gaza. If there's a third one, I will be a martyr. I keep wondering why I'm still alive up till now. I was facing death more than one time. It is the first time to come here after the war. Those memories are ugly, but at the same time, make us feel how strong we are. This place was bombed, and seconds later, we came here again. Some of us refused to get down. This makes me proud of the journalists of Gaza and Palestine, proud of the cameramen and work crews. We are really strong that a rocket was shelled here directly. We were standing here in this direction. We were shooting here with our cameras when the rocket fell here directly on this building. Of course, the destruction remains are still here of what happened in the war. Practically speaking, the moment I would leave home those days, leaving meant we were going towards death. However, when this place was hit by a drone rocket, we started waiting for the F-16 to come. Actually, we turned it into a joke between us and a good spirit. Guys, where would the rockets come from? This direction or that one? This plane or that one? After all, we wanted to work and convey our message. We were scared, but we controlled it and got over it. I would feel I'm on duty and asked to go out and tell the world about what happens and shoot everything to transform the suffering of my nation. If I didn't do this, a mother would lose her children and the child would lose her family with no one knowing about them. Another woman would suffer regardless of being a mother or a sister or a daughter. At the end, it's a duty. It's a testimony for every female journalist in Palestine and Gaza in particular. They are strong. We have unbelievable determination that words cannot express, but we lived that a second time during the Second War. I also confirm that we're going to live the same if there happens any aggression on Gaza. None of the female journalists would back away. We became stronger with more experience.
Isdra has worked in this field since she graduated from university. She was always in the thick of the action. She is known for showing humanitarian news features to the world. Isdra has won the award for the best TV correspondent in the Islamic world.
It was something great. I didn't know about that contest. Those people were following up with our work and reports and collected works of hundreds of female reporters and journalists all over the world. At the end, they decided that I deserve the title of the best female reporter in war covering in the Muslim world. I felt it was the first reward after the war. Rewards are not necessarily money or tangible. The idea of having such a title meant that people were following up with what I was doing and appreciating that I was going to death itself for the sake of telling the world that there is a nation being killed and cleansed. There's a nation witnessing the melting of its people by white phosphorus in front of them. I succeeded in delivering this message, and this was what made me happy the most after the war until now. I could deliver the message.
Lots of stories in Gaza, lots of telling stories in Gaza, and lots of people, lots of successful, lots of negative and positive, and sadness and happiness and tears and firms and lots of things that against life and come with life. It's our turn, it's our responsibility as journalists to work in all those and put it in one circle. And then they cannot say that, oh, because you're a woman, you're sexist in this. No, because I am a refugee Palestinian. I know how to speak in my issue and how to present my own